the two aspects of mother and father, I'm just curious how they would have played in, having an Italian side, having an African American side. How do those influence your sense of identity when you write? Do they factor in a certain extent?
Yes. The short answer is yes, right? I mean, both of those cultures have a strong tradition of storytelling, strong musical traditions. You know, I grew up listening to my Italian family members telling tall tales about other family members, right? Colorful nicknames for certain family members. So sort of grew up like listening to the cadences of that kind of Brooklyn Italian-American speech, you know. And then on the other side of my family, my grandmother, who's still with us, is originally from D.C. So, you know, it was just like a very – then it was a very different conversation. There were still stories being told, but in a different way. So, you know, of course, the food on the table was always different depending on which side of the family we were visiting at the time. For me, it was a very rich environment. Sonically and linguistically, there were lots of stories to think about, lots of questions that I could ask. And in my family, it was, you know, they would talk openly about, you know, ancestors and what they had done and what they were like. It was a good environment to grow up in.
Do you remember the first poem you wrote, or the first time you thought that poetry was something that was worth taking seriously?
Yeah, I remember that the first poem I wrote, I was 6 years old.
Wow.
So I was in first grade. The poem's title was Ode to the Sun. The content has sadly been lost to time. But
well, it sounds incredibly serious, you know, as a 6-7-year-old.
It was many lines of a very serious rhyming verse. So I wrote this poem when I was in first grade. My first grade teacher entered it into a contest or something for the school, and I remember signing my name in like rickety 6-year-old handwriting on this form. And I kind of remember thinking like that something important was about to happen, and that this poem was because of, you know, was the reason. But then, you know, I really didn't think any more about poetry until high school. And at that point, this was at Mercy High School in Baltimore. You know, it's the classic story of encountering an English teacher who like really thought that my work had promise, and she kind of encouraged me to join the writing workshop at the school, which was a very serious endeavor within the school community. So every Monday, a bunch of us literary nerds would all meet, and we would do a workshop session. And at that point, you know, this teacher would talk about MFA programs and places to study writing, and she talked about Iowa, and there was this place where writers could gather and study. And of course I'm hearing those stories, but I guess that high school was really the first context in which I started to think of myself as a poet.
Of course, in high school, I think we all take a lot of literature classes, short story classes, read the classic novels. What made you have an interest, though, in poetry, say, creative writing, studying fiction?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, it sounds weird, but it's never really crossed my mind to try to write a piece of fiction per se. And I think that it's because it may be an attention span thing for me, like, you know, where I'm not sure how long I can really sustain like one cast of characters over time like that and be so attentive to the things you need to be attentive to make a novel, to make a short story a short story. I always have loved reading fiction, and I'm actually rereading Brave New World right now. Prose is just a wonderful form, you know, but I realized at a certain point along my development that I could actually write prose poetry. Yeah. So then it seemed like the perfect solution. Like when I want to write in prose, I can write a prose poem. And at least up until now, that's been a satisfying, you know, poetry has been able to, there's always a form in poetry that will work for me in some way. So I have not felt that I need to depart greatly from poetry.
So let me ask you this then. Even at the age of whether it was 7 or 17 or 27, do you remember then what it is about poetry, even at maybe those younger ages, that made you fall in love with it?
Yeah. Poetry, and I tell my students this, I mean, poetry is a way of thinking about problems, right? So there's a shift in your thinking that has to happen when you become a writer, where you go from thinking about writing as a way to express yourself, like that writing exists for you personally and that's it, and then you at a certain point you mature and start thinking about the ways that writing can be a tool for actually thinking through problems, the biggest problem being the human condition, the fact that we're mortal, the fact that life is finite, the fact that we can't have infinite knowledge about things like loss and pain and death and you know, these kind of poetic subjects that have been discussed for thousands of years. So what makes me fall in love with it again and again is poetry's ability to be elastic and flexible, and to allow certain questions to be asked, to add complexity to my thinking, and also to be very expressive and very musical in its way.
So when you approach a poem, do you approach it with thinking about that issue of a problem? Is that where a poem would start for you, or could it be from a lot of other sources?
I think for me, poems start with sounds. I used to study music. And
what kind of music?
Choral music. I was a choir geek in college and high school. But there was also a lot of popular music that I grew up with. And I remember being a little kid and listening to music, you know, like Casey Kasem's Top 40 countdown in the car with my mother, and thinking and talking to her about what the songs meant, what the lyrics meant. So to me, music and poetry are entwined in that way. So when I sit down to write, I'll have a line or two in my head. It's really good if I can have two lines. One line is okay, but two lines is better. That's when I think I can really actually keep going with the poem. And then the poem will reveal to me what its subject matter is, what the problem is that it wants to think about.
I've heard some poets say before that if you think you have the whole poem mapped out in your head, or you think you know what it is, oftentimes you don't have it. It helps to start from that, from a line or two. Do you find that to be the case with your writing?
I definitely do. But in my book and in the book that I'm going to, that's going to come out this summer, I definitely had forms that I wanted to explore. So I might have, you know, I might sit down and say, well, I want to write in this form. And that is kind of as much of a constraint as I can really allow myself and have a chance of the poem turning out to be any good. So in terms of subject matter and like the actual mode by which the poem will start to unfold its thinking, you can't really predict that. I like to have it. I like it for it to develop organically. But with form, you can, you know, I find that having formal constraints is really a generative practice. So in my first book, there's a section called Valentine where all the poems have the same title. Each poem is called Valentine in that section. When I was writing those poems, I would type Valentine at the top of a blank Word document, and suddenly the poem would start to come out. So there was something about typing that word that helped me. It was a constraint because something that's called Valentine, it can't just be any poem, you know? So
I think that's an issue for people that don't write poetry that seem like two mutually exclusive issues, because form has that idea of entrapment in one way.
Right.
But creativity is what you're talking about at the other hand.
Right. Yeah.
Is there a way that you can describe that process or how those two are not mutually exclusive to some people? You just did in a sense, but is there another aspect of it that you can talk about?
It's paradoxical, you know, that form is actually liberating. And it is very mysterious, and I don't think anyone has ever gotten to the bottom of exactly why it works. But it goes back to what I was saying before, like the poem is its own occasion, and the poem itself has to take some form. It has to have a beginning. It has to have an end. It has to have some kind of procedure by which it operates. And as you mature as a poet, you become better at executing those procedures or selecting a procedure for your poem, whether that's rhyme or whether there's a repeated phrase that works, you know, that does work throughout the poem, whether the title is supposed to be evocative in the poem. And by admitting to yourself and allowing that the poem cannot contain everything, but the poem can talk about many things, then you can start to understand how constraint works together with the creative process.
We're talking a lot about poetry. Why don't we Why don't we hear some? I want to start with an older poem before we get to the newer book. So why don't you tell us about the first poem you're going to read and set it up for us a little bit?
Okay. This poem is called Afro, and it is a prose poem, which means that instead of being a long, skinny piece of text like you would expect a poem to be, it's actually written in the form of a paragraph, so it proceeds from left to right. And whereas in a normal, quote-unquote, poem, you would expect lines, like each line to convey a meaning, what happens in a prose poem is that it's actually each sentence that is the main unit of meaning in a prose poem. So in this poem, taking place in a prose format, I was thinking about the language of the law, particularly the Magna Carta. I was reading it and I really liked its cadences, and I thought maybe I could write a poem that kind of takes advantage of these cadences or plays with them in some way. And so then this is the poem I came up with. Yeah. Afro. Whereas these strands, well-oiled and diligent in their parts, and appearing in tensile character, an iron cloud net several times the diameter of the head, these strands have I, in passing conduct, fidelity, and stewardship, in all protein and mineral accompaniments, in darkness of kerchief and darkness of hands, these have I spirited across the snow and the American seas, from thence to plinths and pallets opportune for discharge of this trust, these strands which rest in trust to me, and which I have dragged a small way into this country, seeking and halting, desirous to prevent mishap, the undue severance of charge, the tease, the crop, and bang, desirous only of those victuals which may furniture my constant guard, whereas for this have I gainsaid the touch of freebooter, the tang of sea rover, and divers others, drinkers, tinkers, kings, and clothiers all. These strands, wherein silence bides, close as horses in an afternoon of rain, these ropes which rise against containment and the blur of slang, for these do I come forth in torrents, do I come forth in tenderness, and earth do I come forth in rage, for these.
That was great. Can you, tell us just a little bit more about what's going on in your mind when you read that, or what was going on in your mind when you wrote that?
Yeah, well, like I said, I was looking at this sort of legal documents, yeah. Famous legal documents from the past, I guess.
A great source of all poetry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I was looking at the Magna Carta. I was also looking at these documents called letters of marque, which were letters that ship's captains would carry. And the letters came from the crown, and they gave the ships permission to basically be pirates, or to divest, you know, the vessels of other countries' ships of, you know, awesome goods, right? Yeah. Commodities. So it was sort of like this permission slip, in a way. But many of the letters of marque that I read also sounded very beautiful. So, I kind of wanted to see how this language that is both, public in the case of something like the Magna Carta, but also in bureaucratic, right? In the case of letters of marque, how I could apply that to a subject like Afro, which is a hairstyle, right? It happens to be my own hairstyle. And how could I contain this subject of black women's hair in a way that felt authentic to me to talk about, and that would also communicate to the audience something about what it is like to have this type of hair, which is often very, causes a lot of curiosity in the observer. So I don't know. I was trying to find a language in which I could open that subject up,
Well, from there, I'd love to jump to the first poem of your new book. Mm-hmm. It's called Personal Style Monologue.
Right.
So, why don't you set this one up, and just as you did before, give us the title and have mm-hmm. at it. I love this poem.
Yeah, Personal Style Monologue came about during a trip that I took to China in 2010. I was part of a delegation of American writers who went to China to meet a similar sized delegation of mainland Chinese writers. Nearly all the Chinese writers in that delegation were members of minority Chinese groups. And so then, the Americans, we had a mix of Caucasian and minority writers. So the point of the exchange was to see if we could find any common ground and write together for 2 weeks. Wow. So it was kind of amazing. We traveled the Silk Road together, and it was great. But one of the challenges that we gave each other was each delegation met on its own. So the Americans met with the Americans, the Chinese met with the Chinese. The goal was to identify a phrase in our respective languages that we felt was untranslatable, and then give that to the other delegation, and the other delegation would have to write a piece about what they thought that phrase meant. Oh. So the phrase that we received in Mandarin was about, like, I can't pronounce the word, but it's sort of about a type of person, I guess, in Chinese culture who kind of believes that they know more than they do. Then I wrote this poem, Personal Style Monologue. The doctor is in, martinis are out. Dirty is in, stripes are out. Absence is out, driving is in. Black lung is in, angry is out. Bacon is in, sparkles are in. Elbows are in, wasp waists are in. Portugal is out, Velveeta is in. The Strokes are out, Kiss is back in. Time travel is in, going out is out. To be in is out, to be out is still out. Blondes are in, blades are in. Vampires are in, gullets are out. The power is out, darkness is in. America is out, America is out. The dark is here.
When I read that poem the first time, the first thing that grabbed me was just this kind of rocking rhythm back and forth to it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that where you started? How did you know it was going to sound like that when you started writing it?
I didn't know that it would sound like that.
Yeah.
I wanted to, again, I started with like the first line, the doctor is in, martinis are out, yeah. Right? And then I thought, yeah, because, there would be these gossip columns, right? And, earlier in the mid-20th century, in which things would be identified as being in and other things would be identified as being out,
yeah.
Right? What's hot and what's not. And so I thought maybe I could make a stab at writing a poem in which there's a speaker that sort of is sort of standing there being the arbiter and saying this is okay and this is not. And so what happened was that the poem started to establish a certain rhythm, and then I just kept with that until the end.
Yeah.
So
one thing else that I noticed also as well was just how colloquial it felt, and these certain little pop references mm-hmm. that you get here. Is that an important thing for you? Is that like a poem by poem basis or something that you like to do? Because obviously it makes the poem relatable for people that are, let's say, younger. But I can see some people saying, some people also think of poetry as this kind of perfect, aloof thing that should not be touched by, you know, mm-hmm. the modern contemporary world. So how do you navigate that kind of an issue in this poem, let's mm-hmm. just say?
Well, in this poem, I wanted to make reference to things that are current trends in our culture, such as the emergence of bacon as object of obsession, but also kind of complicated, you know. But, you know, something I agree, our poem needs to age well, as well as sound good in the moment. So I guess the line that I tried to draw with this piece was thinking about whether the references I was making also had interest as pieces of language or as sounds. So, for instance, the strokes are out, the strokes are banned, but it's also referring probably it's referring to like the way that romance operates also in our culture, and then kisses back in, kiss being another band, but also referring also to intimacy. So I like it when a pop reference can operate on multiple levels and is not just simply a pop reference.
Yeah. Do you like it when you read other poetry that have pop references in them? Do you think it's important, I guess, just in general for poetry to make it more relatable?
I think that that poets must be free to write what is authentic to them. Some poets will incorporate pop references into their poems, and other poets will not. And it should be an organic process for each poet. When I read a pop reference in a poem, it depends on whether the rest of the poem is right. It depends on if the poem is a fine and wonderful poem, then the pop reference probably serves the poem, and that's great. You know, I kind of feel, I guess what I'm saying is I feel the same way about it that I would feel about a poem that did not contain a pop reference. Yeah. You know, we ask ourselves, like, when we're reading a poem, you know, what is the poem trying to say? What are the tools that it uses? Is the poem's message important? You know?
And that's something I'm interested in. We've been talking about rhythm in this case, word choice, and I liked earlier how you said you grew up in a place that had this very, it was a very sonically rich or interesting place. How do you make the tie between the use of sound and music in a poem to an idea of a poem, with trying to translate an idea? How do those two work together?
Well, I will say that they don't always work together perfectly in the first draft, right? So you can produce a draft in which you make a first pass through a subject. And I mean, I tend to write a lot with my ear as well as with my brain, or with my, you know, with whatever agenda I may have. So it may not, you know, certain things may come to you when you're actually revising. And that's your opportunity to think more about how to emphasize certain messages or downplay right. others.
If we think about all these different, you know, again, rhythm, word mm-hmm. choice, idea, can a poem exist with just one of those elements, with just an interesting wordplay, with mm-hmm. just an interesting rhythm, with mm-hmm. just an interesting idea?
Mm-hmm. A poem can begin that way. In general, you want to see that the idea or the sound is developed in some way, and a poet has, you know, hundreds of tools with which to do that. So you may begin with an interesting sound, but a poem exists over time, just like a piece of music does. Mm. So, you know, when we start the poem, where are we? And then when the reader ends the poem, you know, where are we then? So, you know, the poem must take into account the time that it exists on the page, you know.
Let's read one more poem from the forthcoming collection, Ancestors. So tell us about Ancestors, and let's have a reading.
Yeah, Ancestors, in a way, was a commissioned piece. A friend started a literary journal called Unstuck Magazine. And he wanted a Gothic poem. So I had not really tried to write something like that before. So I thought, how could I write something that's a little bit Gothic, a little bit scary, maybe? And so that's how Ancestors came about. One rages white as wood. Another sits ruined at the center of her realm. One of them broods over a clutch of old combs. One darkens like an oyster in the autumn smoke. There's one the shape of a ganglion and one like a yawl. There's one climbing up from the deep planks. You find a glass one, a leather one, a salt one. You watch one dissolve into the embrace of an oak. Already there's one drawing a fine grid on your forehead. There's one disjoining the cables of your wrist. One lives in horses, another in a warp of snow. One's a kind of luster in the mouth. You remember one who taught you to make a kerchief of your hands. Another came in a nightdress browned with spit. Sometimes you glimpse one moving through the woods or whispering through the slits of an iron rake. There's one who waits and one who weeps on the road, but you choose the one who blooms like a war by night, the one pulling another sheaf of your hair into her mouth. That one is always here, that one, that tender trench knife in the head.
Yeah, tell us a little bit more about it.
Well, as the poem got going, I realized it was about aging, about old age, about the process of realizing that you are one in a line of other humans who have gone before you, and about kind of trying to accept the imperfections, maybe the imperfections that you have, and realize, like, you know, you're not the first person to have these imperfections. I think that's what it's about.
Yeah. I like when you said, I think that's what it's about. Do a lot of your poems feel that way?
Yeah. And it's always a surprising and illuminating process to listen to what readers have to say about the poems and to think, you know, listen to the associations that they make with poems. I know that, you know, there are some poets who believe that they are, you know, or say the poet is just a channel through which this language, you know, comes into the world. Actually believe that the poet exerts a lot of control over the poem and is making decisions constantly throughout the poem. But at the same time, writing itself is kind of a magical process. And a piece may exist for a long time before its author truly knows what it's about. So in that way, each poem or each piece of writing has its own life.
Well, we have been speaking already for 30 minutes, amazingly, and that could be a great place to stop. So, okay. Kiki, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming in.
This is great. Thanks. Yeah.